This year is the centenary of Australia's submarine force. It began with the arrival of two submarines just a few months before the outbreak of World War One in 1914. Peter Horobin is the president of the Submarine Institute of Australia. He was a submariner for almost 20 years and joins us. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Trevor. How are you?
Good, Peter. Can you take us back, take us back 100 years and tell us about those first submarines?
Australia's first submarines were E-class, built in Britain in Barrow and Furness by Vickers, and they were known as AE1 and AE2, A for Australia, and obviously 1 and 2, fairly logical. They travelled to Australia in the early part of 1914 and arrived in Sydney on the 24th of May 1914.
How big were they?
They were about 1,000 tonnes.
Mm.
Not very big at all, probably about, 80 metres long.
And why is it that they were sent to Australia? Why did we need submarines?
That's an entertaining story at the time. The Chief of Navy at the time, Sir William Creswell, went to Britain representing the young colony to buy its, well, young nation as it was then, to... Mm. By its navy, and he went to the Admiralty and ordered battleships because they were very fashionable at that stage. He ordered three. He made the mistake of leaving London ahead of the Prime Minister, Alfred Deakin, who stayed on in London for a few more days, and Alfred Deakin went round to the Admiralty and said, "Can I look at the list?" and amended it because submarines were a little cheaper. So Australia ended up with one battleship and two submarines and a number of cruisers and destroyers.
When you take a look at the needs for Australia at that time, you would think submarines may not have been at the top of the list.
They weren't. I mean, from the eyes of the Navy, the Navy saw itself as an element of the British Royal Navy. And from Admiral Creswell's point of view, submarines didn't feature. Submarines were also very new at that stage, some 10 years, really only about 10 or 15 years after the first submarine really came into being.
Were they reliable?
No. They were powered by diesel engines, which I have to say was a significant improvement on their predecessors. A-class submarines and B-class submarines had petrol engines, which made them very unpleasant and quite dangerous to be in. The E-class submarines had diesel engines, obviously very early diesel engines, and not always reliable. So both submarines spent some of the journey being towed by the cruiser HMAS Sydney on the way to Australia because their engines were defective at the time.
Given that we've now got these submarines and they've been brought here, was there a need for specific training for submariners that time, or did we bring submariners out with them?
The crews of both submarines were a mixture of Australian sailors and British sailors, about half and half. And the Australians had conducted their training in the United Kingdom. So the training wasn't quite as structured as it is now. So the training was also by sort of a process of osmosis. You know, inside the submarine, you start to learn quite quickly.
Once we get the submarines here and we've trained up some submariners to operate them, did we find then that we had a use for them, or were they still a sort of a second cousin to the rest of our Navy?
Oh, no. The First World War started very quickly quite shortly after they arrived. So they undertook an overhaul in Cockatoo Island Dockyard in Sydney, and then First World War started in August, and they were deployed with other elements of the Australian fleet to pursue the German Pacific Fleet, which was based in Rabaul in Papua New Guinea. And so they were on patrol in September 1914 against the German Navy.
We'll go to some calls and we'll pick up that point from the First World War in a minute. We'll go to some calls. Brendan, firstly. Hello, Brendan.
Hi. The survivors, they too, when they were captured by the Turks, they had to unpack sunshine harvesters out of their wooden container boxes, or the transport boxes, and also they worked on what was called the Berlin-Baghdad railway line, but I don't know if it was ever finished. But what I really wanted to question is, in the last 3 years or 4 years, I read an article that in World War II, the Australian Navy took over and operated a Dutch submarine for a couple of years.
Do you know anything about that, Peter?
Yeah, the Australian Navy took over a Dutch submarine called K-9. K-9 was not really in good shape when we received it, and it was spent most of its time in Sydney, and really wasn't used as an operational submarine.
Let's continue the use of the submarines that we had in World War One. Were they proven to be effective, and there was a need then or a thought to get more submarines?
There was at the time. A1, sadly, was sunk in the operation against the Germans in September, on the 14th of September 1914. It was our first major casualty in the First World War. Lost with all hands. AE-2 sailed with the second convoy of the AIF to the Middle East, and AE-2 is quite famous in submarine history. It was the first Allied submarine to penetrate the Dardanelles. It did so on Anzac Day 1915. Some say that it's one of the reasons that Australian soldiers are called diggers. AE-2 managed to get through the Dardanelles against quite significant odds, and send a message to the headquarters in HMS Queen Elizabeth at about 8 o'clock on the evening of the 25th of April 1915. The headquarters was not a very happy place at that stage. They were receiving extremely bad news, saying that basically all of the landings were in difficulty. And the recommendation from the Anzac landings was that the Anzacs be withdrawn. General Hamilton received the message from AE-2 and felt this was some indicator of a reason to be optimistic, and send a message back to General Birdwood, who was on the beach at Anzac Cove, saying, stay where you are, it's going to be all right. The Australian submarines got through into the Sea of Marmara, so dig and make yourself safe. Now, for whether that is a factual story or not, it's a good one anyway.
Oh, no, we always go with those on these programs.
Absolutely.
Always go with a good story. John, good morning. You there, John?
Oh, good morning.
Yes, John.
Oh, yes, Trevor, I was just, this might be slightly out of context as what your guest is talking about, but I'm from Newcastle, and during World War II, you know, the attacks on Sydney with the Japanese midget submarines are well known, but about a week after that, Newcastle was sort of attacked by a larger Japanese submarine, and now land-based forward fired off a couple of salvos that bracketed the ship and was just about to plant one on it when a local vessel in the middle of the battle decided to get the hell home and went intercepted, so the firing was stopped. So your guest may be able to elaborate a little bit on that.
John?
John's better informed than I am on that particular action, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Do you find it interesting, though, Peter, and that we tend to hear more about the Japanese submarines that came into Sydney and we've heard about Newcastle and that sort of thing, than you really hear about our own submariners?
I find that a constant source of concern, quite frankly. Submarines played a significant role in the First World War, but submarines played a critical role in the Second World War in the defence of Australia. Fremantle was the second largest submarine base in the world, and people never talk about that. The submarine operations, there were United States submarines based in Brisbane for most of the Second World War, and the submarines based in Fremantle and Brisbane were probably the most effective submarines in any operation anywhere in the world.
Yeah, and I've always just found that interesting, that those stories are so well known.
Yeah.
Let's go back again, because we've just heard that we had two submarines. Do you say submarines get sunk?
A2 was sunk on the 30th of April 1915.
So we then got more submarines in 1919.
Correct.
Can you tell us about those?
We got six J class from the United Kingdom again. Sadly, these were not reliable submarines. Again, the diesel engine of the day was not as good as people would hope. And the requirement sort of dissipated because with the war it stopped. These submarines were based in Geelong, and indeed you'll find the wreck of two of them scattered around Port Phillip. There's one in Sandringham Yacht Club, part of the sort of breakwater at Sandringham. And there's another one on Swan Island, or the wreck of one on Swan Island. The wrecks of the rest of them are to the south of Queenscliff in Bass Strait.
Okay. Gary, good morning.
Good day, mate. How are you?
Good, Gary.
One thing that really throws me back, I've been listening to you guys for ages, and they're talking about things that happened in 1915. We've got a Collins-class submarine now, which is almost 99 years later from the last speaker. It's supposedly the noisiest submarine in the world. And now government has spent a lot of money on that. I wonder, of all these people who are so astute about everything, the U-boats for the Germans, why does no one ring up and speak with you?
Because, Gary, we're starting at the beginning and we're moving forward. We just hadn't got there yet.
Maybe I've got them forward quickly because...
yeah, that's right. No, we will talk about that because we're just talking about there was a bit of disaster with the boats that came here in 1919, and possibly we can say that there's been a bit of a disaster with the Collins class as well. So we'll talk briefly about the Collins class, Peter.
I would dispute there's been a disaster with the Collins class. Collins class is a very successful submarine. The difficulty in discussing current submarine operations is that you can't, in simple.
But it's been surrounded by controversy, Collins class.
That's right, absolutely.
And so much money spent on those submarines, and as far as the rest of us know, that they stood whether or not they're actually operational.
There are four operational today.
Yep.
They're all performing the duties that are expected of them, and they're performing them very well. They are a quiet submarine. They're a very effective submarine. There were challenges at the early stages of their lives, as you would have in any new vehicle. It's a very sophisticated vehicle. And Australia should be extremely proud of Collins class. There isn't a conventionally powered submarine that is as good at it as it is.
I've got a question here from Kyron, and we'll elaborate on this as well. He said he's very interested in sonar. Can you ask or guess how sonar systems were developed over the years? I guess what we can add to that is how Australia has been involved in the development of submarines over the years. Can we talk about that, Peter?
Yep, yeah, certainly. To go to sonar, one of the contributions Australia's made to the field of sonar is the application of what's called passive ranging. In the Oberon-class submarine, Australia, with some assistance from the United States and the United Kingdom, but then took it a step further. They fundamentally put three transducers down each side of the submarine, and used the submarine as a baseline to measure the curvature of the sound signal coming towards the submarine. If you measure the curvature, you've got an idea of the circumference. If you know the circumference, you should be able to work out what the radius is, and the radius is going to be the range of the target. So in that process, we developed a passive way of detecting the range of another ship or of a noise source. That at the time that was done, that was seen to be world-leading. That was done in the sort of 1960s and 70s. Subsequently, Australia developed in what was called the Submarine Weapons Update Program quite a sophisticated combat system, and basically demonstrated the capacity of a small number of Australian companies to do some very advanced work.
Hello, Chris.
Hey, how you going, man?
Yeah, good, Chris. Yeah, can you turn your radio off, Chris?
Yeah,
if everyone can turn their radios off, it makes life a lot easier.
No, not a problem.
Okay, well, off you go.
Hey, yeah, fine.
Yeah, what did you want to say, Chris?
I just want to, what happened to the little submarines in the Sydney Harbour? You know, those little mini subs and all that stuff.
Yeah, again, this is the Japanese submarines.
Yeah, that's what I was going to be. Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about.
Look, we're trying to talk a bit about Australian submarines, and again, it's the Japanese submarines that cop a bit of a mention. However, within that, Peter, were there submarines, because there's an awful lot of talk about the Japanese getting in there, were there Australian submarines operating off the coast there?
Australia didn't have submarines of its own at that stage, and there were no Allied submarines operating in the area at that stage.
So that's why.
Yeah, I would argue that's why.
Let's take a look then, at because we spoke briefly about the submarines in World War II. Why were they so significant to the Australian Navy in World War II?
The submarines in World War II were significant for Australia because for a period in 1942, they were the only defence we had. There was nothing else. Then during the remainder of the period from 42 to 45.
Can we just back up a minute? Why was it that that's all we had?
Singapore had fallen. The Australian ships fighting in the Battle of Java Sea and the Battle of Sunda Strait were sunk and defeated by the Japanese. The Japanese were charging down through what's now Indonesia and into New Guinea. Today, people would say that they were not going to travel much further than New Guinea, but at the time, nobody knew that. People were assuming that they were coming, going to keep on coming, and there was nothing that could get in their way or stop them, other than the submarines.
When you take a look at that, who were these significant submariners associated with the Navy around that time?
In the context of the submarines operating out of Australia, they were predominantly at that stage United States submarines or Dutch submarines. And the sort of more famous names in the United States submarines were an Admiral Lockwood, who was later to become the commander of the submarine force in the Pacific and fought the Japanese really from Pearl Harbor. But Captain Lockwood, as he was then, set up the base in Fremantle. And he was one of the early sort of famous names at that stage.
If you'd like
there
to
were Australians in the British Navy in submarines at that stage fighting in the Atlantic. A gentleman, Sir Ian McIntosh, or became Sir Ian McIntosh, was a young man from Victoria, went to Geelong Grammar. He wanted to join the Navy. His parents wouldn't let him go to the Naval College at the age of 13, so he, at the age of 18, took himself to the United Kingdom and joined the British Navy.
I've got a text here that says, we had some submarine action at Port Kembla Harbour during World War II. I'm just asking if you know anything about that.
No, I don't. I imagine this is a continuation of the operations of the Japanese submarine that was harassing Newcastle.
Can we go back again a little bit further and take a look at the X-craft and tell us a little bit about those miniature submarines?
Yeah, X-craft were small, they called them 10-ton submarines. They were quite small submarines, crew of four, and they carried a large explosive. The some people may be familiar with the story of the raid against Tirpitz, which was a very large German battleship at anchor in a Norwegian fjord. The X-craft were deployed against Tirpitz to sink it. In fact, were successful in that they blew a hole in Tirpitz, and Tirpitz basically sat down on the bottom of the fjord and stayed there for the rest of the war. A surprising number of Australians were served in those vessels. There were five Australians participating in the raid on Tirpitz. About a year later, another Australian led a raid in Bergen, also in Norway, and an Australian driving in command of an X-craft, Lieutenant Ken Hutsforth, surveyed the beaches for the landing at Normandy and was actually a beacon for the Allied ships landing, coming into land at Normandy, so that they could basically set himself up so they could see him and then go in then into the beach safely. West Australian Max Sheehan, in an X-craft, cut the cable from Singapore to Saigon and then from Saigon to Hong Kong, forcing the Japanese to use HF radio rather than the telephone. And that allowed the Allies to intercept that communication, that gave the Allies a clearer indication of the Japanese intentions and resolve to continue fighting.
When you say that that operation, that he cut the cable, can you tell us what that meant or what he did?
As there are today, there was a fairly large, about 3-inch diameter steel cable carrying telephone lines from Singapore to Saigon, so which was laid on the seabed by a cable laying ship. This particular cable came up to, I think, Cape St. Jacques as the point that it comes into Vietnam, and then came back out again roughly the same location, and is on the seafloor across to Hong Kong. So the Japanese were using that as its sort of a strategic communications link, using, as I say, telephone lines in the seafloor rather than using radio. Now, the Allies were anxious to get some indication of what the Japanese would or would not do, and therefore were trying to intercept their communications. So by using a rather large set of bolt cutters, quite bluntly, a diver, and the diver in this particular case was another Australian, Lieutenant Ken Briggs, who lives up in Brisbane, swam out of the X-craft with a very large bolt cutter and cut about a metre length out of the cable.
Jeez. That's an incredibly brave thing to do. Well, I guess it's part of his job.
Yeah, that's what he was paid to do. Some of the things that those characters did would make your hair curl today. Occupational health and safety people would be a bit worried about them.
Good morning, Bill.
Oh, good morning. How are you? I'm enjoying it very much.
Good, Bill. What did you want to say?
My comment was, many years ago, the ABC put out a television program called The Secret Fleet, which was about the submarines based in Fremantle. Indeed, it was a secret fleet. It was pretty well a secret even to today. But my uncle was manpowered out of the army. He'd been in the army for 6 months to work on the submarines as a fitter. I have a list of over 78 submarines that he did actually work on, which were mainly American, but of course there were British and Dutch, British S-class. I think it was 12 or 15 of them, and I'm not quite sure the number, but it's only a handful of Dutch. But the thing that fascinated me was that of over 50% of the Japanese tonnage were sunk by submarines out of Fremantle, but more importantly, 70% of the Japanese tankers were sunk by submarines based out of Fremantle, which would have been a significant effect on the entire war effort. But not only were they based at Fremantle, there is a plaque in Albany, which is south of Fremantle, where over 65 submarines operated out of, at different times, operated out of Albany. So from the West Coast point of view, it was a very significant base. And
Yeah, and a very significant role in the Second World War, especially in the Pacific.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I did work with a gentleman who was on the S-class submarines. In fact, that's the reason he emigrated back out to Australia. He enjoyed it so much in Fremantle.
Hmm.
And he was comparing the American fleet submarines to the S-class he was on, which, of course, didn't have the range of the American fleet star. But he did. He did tell me about the time where they picked up some Japanese prisoners of a logging ship that they'd sunk up in Indonesia, and they were ordered to rendezvous with an American submarine at Exmouth on the way south. Both were going south. At any rate, they handed over the Japanese prisoners and took enough supplies and fuel off the American submarine, went back out and did another two weeks patrol while the American submarine continued on to Fremantle. It was quite interesting.
Good on you, thank you.
Anyway.
I did just want to comment, because it's interesting conversations that that Bill's saying there, Peter. Do you just want to comment on what he's saying?
He reports accurately. The patrols out of Fremantle were incredibly effective, and the loss of tankers in particular really had a devastating effect on the Japanese capacity to fight, so that fundamentally they reached a point really from the middle of 1944 where they were unable to support their own troops in the field, and they were finding it even more difficult to survive at home because they didn't have fuel and they didn't have food. So life was not good.
Given that we had the base in Fremantle, why was there a need for another base in Albany?
Albany was a fallback from Fremantle. There was a fear in 1943 that the Japanese would send a carrier group south to attack Fremantle because of the effect of the submarines. And so the American and Dutch submarines very quickly moved out of Fremantle for about 3 weeks down to Albany to avoid the possibility of an airstrike from the Japanese. As events turned out, that didn't happen.
And did they have those bases? Because I was just looking logistically, those bases are a fair way south of the battles that were occurring. Was that because it was safer to have them a little bit further south?
Yes.
Instead of having them up in Darwin or in
Darwin? Darwin's got two problems. One, it was a bit close to the heat, to the action. But the other one is that it's quite shallow water in the area around Darwin, so the submarine would be forced to stay on the surface for some time before it got out into an area where it could dive. So thereby sort of basically giving the enemy an indication of where it was going and what, and also putting the submarine at risk. At the time also, the logistic support necessary to support the submarines was not in Darwin. One of the benefits of what happened in Fremantle and also in Brisbane was that the local railways became the railway workshops became submarine support bases. So the Midland Railway Workshop in Western Australia basically became a submarine maintenance base, and many of the tradesmen working there, as indeed as Bill's relative was, worked hard on submarines.
So that's, I mean, Midlands, although on the railway line, is still a fair way from Fremantle.
Yeah, well, there was also the state engineering works down in Fremantle at that stage, okay. So it wasn't quite sort of all the way up to Midland. They were going up another railway line as well.
Michael, good morning.
Good morning, Trevor. How are you?
Good, Michael.
My uncle was a submariner, and then my cousin, well, my uncle was in World War II, my cousin in the Korean conflict. I went on a submarine in Sydney Harbour and out up past the Gosford area, and I came back, and there was no way I was going down there again. I went to 9 Squadron Helicopters, Vietnam. The stories they have told me and the stress that was put on these people, they are heroes. And what happened with my uncle was he had a mild breakdown, but he was never right after that. My cousin did extremely well. He ended up the mayor of Shoalhaven, and he did extremely well. But the stories I've heard of the type of people that would be successful in submarines would curl your hair, and it's very, very special people who can
survive. Well, live it. I mean, sorry? Peter, yeah, I mean, I guess live it is what Michael's saying there, Peter. But you were a submariner yourself for 20 years. Is there a certain breed of person that becomes a submariner, and do you volunteer to be a submariner, Peter?
In the Australian Navy, all submariners are volunteers for submarines. I've seen people who were in other navies who were encouraged to become submariners somewhat against their will, and it's not good. It's not nice for them. People who are claustrophobic know they're claustrophobic, and they know they should stay away from a submarine, and people shouldn't try and force them into it. To pick up Michael's comment about the stress, it would probably interest Michael. People were concerned about that point in the late 1970s, and so they appointed a professor of psychology to look at the submarine community and find out, you know, just what was happening and whether they were. The assumption was that they were all very stressed, and the assumption was that there needed to be something done about it. He did a set of analysis and like all psychologists, a lot of statistics, and to his amazement, found that all the people he was talking to were so laid back they were almost comatose. Now, his conclusion was that submariners have an unusually high tolerance of stress. In fact, most of them are fairly laid back people.
Just being in there would be stressful enough.
Yeah, except that, yeah, well, so you say, but I never noticed. That might tell you something else.
I've just got a text here. I'll go back to calls in just a second. There was a story a while ago on the ABC about an Australian submarine doing a rescue during the Korean War that wasn't sanctioned. Can you tell us about that?
There were no Australian submarines in that era. So I don't know.
Maybe it's just very secretive, Peter.
Yeah, but except it was so secret we didn't know we owned the submarine.
Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Edgar.
Are you one of that special breed?
Yeah, it's been eight and a half years.
And tell us about what you liked about it, Bill.
Mateship, professionalism. Like, you can't talk about the submarine community without talking about the mateship. We're all brothers, no matter what country we're in. Anyone that wears the dolphin. But the professionalism, there's nowhere else you'd know where a cook can start an engine or a steward could isolate an electrical system. It was just a different lifestyle.
So is there a real need for submariners to be multi-skilled, Bill?
Well, if something goes wrong and you're 600 foot underwater, then whoever's the closest has to get it going again.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. Can you elaborate on that, Peter? Is that right?
Oh, Bill's quite right. And the expectation particularly of Oberon sailors, of which Bill was one, was that they should be able to do any of the more routine skills, no matter where they were in the boat. So they should know their systems, they should be able to operate any valve, and they should be able to operate certain pieces of equipment. They're really part of the safety system of the boat. There are specialist trades. You know, a radio operator would be specialist in his field, but there was an expectation that the radio operator would be able to operate any piece of equipment, any piece of safety equipment in the boat.
Mary, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, Mary.
Did the chap there know anything about the V-class submarines that were based at Kirribilli during the war?
Peter?
No, I don't. I'm afraid I'm not.
What did you want to say, Mary?
I wanted to ask that chap if he knew anything about V-class submarines.
What did you know about them, Mary?
I was married to one.
Oh, ex-submariner?
Yeah.
A British submariner?
Yes.
Yep.
And he was based at Kirribilli during the war. There were three submarines there.
Yep.
The Virtue, the Vox, and the Voracious.
And, Mary, what was it like being married to a submariner?
Not very good.
No?
They were never home very much, you know. I mean, they were only here for a few years.
Yeah.
And I met my husband in town, and we got married in Sydney.
Lovely.
And he lived in Sydney all his life.
Mary, thank you. I just want to go back to Peter, because one of the things that was mentioned earlier from Bill is the camaraderie amongst submariners. Do you notice that, Peter, if you go back to submariners from your time, and if there are any still with us from the Second World War, through to the submariners now, is there still that camaraderie?
Oh, yes. Yeah. It's a very, very close-knit group of people. We enjoy, well, certainly I enjoy other submariners' company. The stories get taller and taller.
Of course they do.
Yeah.
It'd be a shame if they didn't. True. And the great thing is that because of the highly classified nature of the work that submariners do, who's going to prove that they're not?
Absolutely.
Peter, we're about a minute and a half from the news. Tell us what's going to be happening to recognise 100 years of submariners in Australia and submarines.
So we're going to have a series of events around Australia. Holbrook is, you might think, is an unusual place to celebrate submarines, but Holbrook is named after a submariner of the First World War. Holbrook was previously known as Germantown, and the local council was somewhat anxious not to call itself Germantown in 1914-15, and chose the name Holbrook after a fairly famous submariner. As a result, there's been a long connection with submarines. So Holbrook's sort of the first point. On the 25th of April, there'll be a celebration down there. 24th of May, there'll be a celebration in Sydney to commemorate the arrival of AE1 and AE2. And during the year, there'll be activities in Geelong, in Albany, and in Brisbane. And then there'll be Submarine Week in Fremantle in November. And we finished the sort of centenary year with another event in Anzac Day in Holbrook.
We'll look forward to following those events as they go along. Peter, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, Trevor, nice to talk to you.
Peter Horriban, the president of the Submarine Institute of Australia and a submariner for 20 years.